Services. You ready to proceed, Mr. Castle?
Yes, I am, Your Honor. May it please the court, Justice Holland, Justice Berger, Justice Ridgely. I first want to thank the court for hearing this appeal. I recognize the burden that we have. It's our position that there is a verdict of no negligence in a case in which the overwhelming evidence was that there was negligence, and I would even go so far as to say that the unanimous weight of the evidence is that there was negligence in this case. And it follows from that that in our view there was not sufficient supporting information, evidence, or data to support the expert opinion that the defense presented in this case from Dr. Miller, namely that there had been no breach of the standard of care. All of the surgeons who testified agreed that Mr. Kemp's median nerve was severed through and through the moment that he stuck his hand through the window pane and pulled it back. There was never any dispute about that. Once that happened, it is physiologically impossible for a human being to do this. It just can't be done. And the analogy I turn to is the wire from the electric outlet to a lamp. Once that's cut and the switch to the lamp is flipped, there's not going to be any light coming from that light bulb. It can't be done. It follows from that that the preoperative examination of Mr. Kemp by the trauma team, in which the notation is made N/V intact, it can't be right. It can't be right on two accounts. Number one, there's no nerve connection. But secondly, the man's bleeding and spurting blood, so how they can arrive at the conclusion that the vascular aspect of it was intact, just makes no sense. Then the second opportunity to ascertain the nature of this injury occurs in the operating room, when the trauma surgeon, who easily could have called at 6 o'clock in the evening for the on-call hand surgeon to come in, and why that was never done has never been sufficiently explained, waits 8 or 9 hours, then takes the patient into the operating room and examines the wound and says that he saw the median nerve intact. Impossible. Could not happen. The only explanation is that he wasn't looking at the median nerve, or the nerve had retracted to some extent and he did not see where it had been severed. But he cannot come to the conclusion that the median nerve was uninjured or intact at that point. Then,
Your client described numbness postoperatively to the surgeon's office, is that right?
He did, and it's documented in the note by the nurse at 6:45 in the morning. The surgery concluded about 3:30.
But didn't he later say it was improving? Did he later say it was improving, the numbness?
Not in the hospital.
I mean, I understand that, but later, did he say it was improving?
There's a notation a week later by the doctor that the numbness was improving. But again, that's a physiological impossibility because the nerve had been severed.
Well, but nonetheless, your client said it. Is that right?
According to the note that the doctor writes.
So, at this stage, we have to accept that.
But we also have to recognize that it's impossible. It can't be. When that nerve is severed, that there can be any sensation in that area.
Mr. Castle?
Yes.
I understand that there's a bad result here, but bad results don't necessarily mean negligence. And you place a lot of emphasis on the fact that the nerve definitely was severed from the time he had the accident. And even assuming that's absolutely true and indisputed, that still doesn't mean that a capable doctor didn't see that it was severed and thought that it was intact and proceeded accordingly. Don't you have to be able to establish that nobody could have missed this in order to prevail?
I don't think, Your Honor, I have to go that far. But I do take the position that the preoperative examination was deficient. It could not be correct, as reported in the record. The operative observation that the nerve was intact can't be correct. And the postoperative follow-up was thoroughly inadequate.
But again, when you say it can't be correct, the surgeon is in there and sees something that he believes is the nerve intact and says, you know, proceeds accordingly. So it's not that you're saying the surgeon lied, but rather that the surgeon misperceived whatever he was looking at, right?
Yeah, certainly misperceived it, yes.
But again, those things happen, as unfortunate as it may be. How is it a breach of the standard of care for the doctor to have mistakenly believed that the nerve was intact?
I would analogize it to a rear-end collision. Somebody strikes the car because they didn't see it. He's a trained surgeon. He undertook to do this surgery when he should have handed it off to a hand surgeon. But once he undertook to do it, he had a duty to do it right. And no matter how it's looked at, we have to conclude that it was not done correctly. He missed it, and he acknowledged that he missed it.
But again, you seem to be asking the court to make the jump from a bad result to negligence. And we all know that, unfortunately, there are a lot of times when doctors perform procedures and it doesn't wind up with a good result. That doesn't mean that they committed negligence.
As a general proposition, I certainly agree. In this particular case, Your Honor, it's our view that this could not have happened in the absence of negligence at three different levels.
But the defendant's expert testified that this is the type of thing that is missed, and missing the diagnosis is not a breach of the standard of care. It happens. Wasn't that the testimony?
In general, yes, that's true.
And you've been very candid in saying that this is going to be a difficult appeal for you given the standard of review. But what do we do with that on appeal when you have a jury assessing the credibility of two experts and one expert says it's within the standard of care to miss this diagnosis, the other says it's outside the standard of care, and the jury picks the defense expert? How do we set that aside? I know that you talked about there's no doubt the nerve was severed, and you gave a reasonable explanation about it retracting and maybe it wasn't observed. But at the end of the day, if we assume there's no doubt it was severed, but we have an expert witness who says missing that is within the standard of care, and the jury believes that expert, how do we reverse that on appeal?
Well, I think Your Honors can look at the underlying evidence and supporting data for the expert's opinion. And in this particular case, it simply isn't there. It doesn't exist, because he knew when he testified that that nerve had been cut. So he necessarily knew that the preoperative neurovascular examination could not be right. And he also knew when he testified that the observation by the surgeon that he saw the nerve could not be correct. And then, postoperatively, he attaches importance to the nurse's note at 6:45 in the morning that reports a nerve injury.
I assume he was cross-examined on all those points?
Yes, and I thought I had done a fairly decent job, but obviously didn't work.
Well, what did he say in response? He must have had an explanation.
Well, what he said in response to the last point was that he would have watched this patient very closely after the nurse reported the nerve damage. That was at 6:45 in the morning. No physician, no member of the trauma team, nobody else examined the patient from 6:45 a.m. until he went home at 2 o'clock in the afternoon.
But so that brings us to the dilemma posed by the state of the law. Your arguments seemed to have suggested the expert opinion was inadmissible. But that's not where, that's not the way the issue's framed on appeal, and that's not what happened at trial. So if we go back to the Daubert case itself, where we're talking about experts, and I admit this fellow was a credible expert, it's just a question, you're challenging his opinion. But Daubert said, you know, once the expert opinion is in, then the best test is cross-examination. So going back to my question, we have an opinion that is admissible, and the jury accepts it. How do we get over that on appeal?
Well, I think the court has the authority and the power to look behind it, even though this expert perhaps could have been successfully challenged in a Daubert application, which I did not make. But we've crossed that bridge. But I don't think this court is limited to accepting at face value what the expert says. The expression I used in the brief was a credentialed expert comes in and ipsy dixit says, I think whatever I think, and that's enough. But the court can look at what is supporting that opinion.
Now,
and
the difficulty we're having from a procedural point of view is that when testimony evidence is admissible, even if it's weak, even if there are credibility challenges, once it's admitted and fair game for the trier of fact, if the trier of fact accepts admissible evidence, then we have to give a lot of deference to the factual determination that's made.
I would certainly agree with that, a lot of deference, but not total deference. And the standard is whether the verdict is against the great weight of the evidence. And I certainly submit that the court has the power to look at the weight of the evidence and make that determination independently. But I fully acknowledge the difficulty. I recognize that.
You have about 7.5 minutes. You wanted to reserve 5.
Yes, Your Honor. And the only other point I would want to emphasize again is Dr. Miller, the defense expert's testimony that this patient, post-operative, once he had regained consciousness and could report his symptoms and so forth, and they're documented as being as a nerve injury by the nurse, and then he says, I would want to watch that patient very closely, and no one ever looked at him.
I want to ask you something about the standard of review and great weight of the evidence. And we also have a constitutional provision, Article 4, Section 11.1a, on appeal from a verdict of a jury, the finding of the jury, if supported by the evidence, shall be conclusive. How does that mesh with against the great weight of the evidence? Because great weight of the evidence assumes that there may be some evidence, but it's just not much. And the constitutional provision says if supported by the evidence, which presumably means any evidence, or does it mean something different?
Well, in the context of an expert opinion, I would argue that the evidence supporting the expert opinion can be analyzed to see if it supports that opinion. The opinion came in, but it came in on wings because there was no underlying support for it. And I think the court does have the authority to look at that. Thank you, Your Honor. I'm sorry.
Mr. Galperin, good morning.
Good morning. Richard Galperin for the appellee, Christiana Care, with Allison DiRocco, who assisted me on the briefs and also is here this morning. The scope of the review, as has been acknowledged by the appellant, is abuse of discretion. This is the decision of a trial court which reviewed all of the evidence and was present during, the trial and upheld the verdict. The appellant's sole basis for asking this court to overturn this is that the decision was against the great weight of the evidence and abuse of discretion. We have cited in our briefs numerous cases, medical negligence cases, where the court has held with very similar arguments raised by appellants based on the great weight of the evidence, and I'm not going to go through them. As has been pointed out by Justice Ridgely, the unwillingness of this court to overturn a jury verdict is a constitutional issue, and it goes to the very core concept of our jury trials, that we put these matters before jurors, and if the jurors reach a finding and the finding is supported by the evidence, then that's to be left alone. Only in extraordinary circumstances does this court overturn both the trial court's abuse of discretion standard and the jury's verdict. This is not a case where there are legal issues such as errant jury instructions or comments of counsel, improperly admitted evidence. These are not the issues here. I think that makes my task one of simply telling the court where there has been more than sufficient evidence in our position as the appellees that there was a qualified expert that took the position that there was no breach of the standard of care in this case. The appellant argues ipsy dixit, as been pointed out already in this oral argument. This is not a pretrial Daubert motion, in which case the plaintiff, now an appellant, would have argued that the opinions of the expert are so devoid of a basis that they should not be admitted at all. Not only wasn't that done in this case, there would have been no basis to do it. Dr. Miller's testimony was credible and well supported by his testimony. This is not a methodology case, a junk science case. Dr. Miller is the chairman of the trauma department at Vanderbilt University, which, according to his testimony, is the fourth largest trauma facility in the country. His credentials were impeccable and not challenged, and he has, most importantly, the experience to talk about these kinds of situations and to talk about the key point here, that an injury can be missed and not be breached of standard of care. This is the central concept of medical malpractice, medical negligence law. The jury was instructed that find for the plaintiff, they must find that there is a conduct that was below that of a reasonably prudent doctor under same or similar circumstances. With the evidence presented to them, with the jury instruction given to them, they reached a very reasonable and well-supported verdict. This case involves the case of a trauma surgeon. Dr. Miller was a trauma surgeon. He said in his testimony on this issue of can you miss an injury and be within the standard of care, and he said at trial, he talked about the fact that he gives lectures on this very subject, the unfortunate fact that injuries can be missed. And he was asked, when you give this lecture, and when you teach about missed injuries, you teach that a missed injury is an indication of substandard care. Answer, absolutely not. This is a known entity and an expected entity in our specialty. He went on in the evidence presented at trial to testify that the following question and answer. When you review this file I sent to you, this is my questioning, you had the information from Dr. Sella a year and a half later, where he had discovered that there had been a median nerve injury, correct? Yes. How did the knowledge that you knew at that time that he had later been discovered to have a median nerve injury affect your process of determining the standards of care? And Dr. Miller answered, well, hindsight is obviously 20/20, and obviously it affects your thought process. But what I tried to do in this circumstance is put myself in the same circumstance that Dr. Schweike was in with this patient, and I would have done the same things, and that's how I base my judgment on this. Whether or not an injury was found later on, I tried to avoid thinking about that as I was going through the reasoning process for the circumstances.
What limits this missed injury doctrine? If experts say that, well, things happen, injuries get missed, when do you cross the line and when is a not detecting something negligence.
What limits that, Your Honor, is the adversarial process that Mr. Castle, the appellant's counsel, brings into the courtroom a doctor who says, no, that's not how this works. We can't excuse all missed injuries. And the jury listens to that, and the jury weighs that against the testimony that we raised. What the jury uses as support for this kind of opinion is the level of experience of the testifying expert. And here, Dr. Miller testified that he not only has experience, but he lectures on this subject. I don't think the position of the appellee here is that every missed injury is necessarily within the standard of care. But the testimony this jury heard very clearly, both on direct exam, and there's pages of it, which I'm certainly not going to present to the court, but there's pages of testimony by Dr. Miller on direct and with the efforts of Mr. Castle on cross to take the position that Your Honor raises. Well, you just say it was missed. Is that enough? And he explained how these things can happen, particularly in this case, relying upon the recorded records of the patient appearing to be neurovascularly intact, not to mention the type of injury, the depth of the injury here, the difficulty in looking into this bundle where all these nerves and arteries are, the possibility of retraction. And I think he explained well, and the jury certainly accepted that. I will not take the time of reading all this, talked about the appearance of them being neurovascularly intact. He talked about the decision-making that he did as he went through this case with this patient, the decision to do the surgery, the manner in which he chose to do it, and exactly what the anatomy was that was faced by Dr. Schweike. The same concept in the testimony was given concerning the postoperative issues, including the fact that Mr. Kemp appeared to be doing better, so that even at a later time, it wasn't to be presumed that there was a severance. One of the things that has to be thought about, because it was presented to the jury, was the issue here isn't really was there a missing of a severance, but was there missing of a nerve injury? Clearly, there was some nerve injury developing. But that isn't the issue because if it's a nerve injury, you just have to let it try to heal. What was not known here was that it was severed. I think that I'm not going to take up anywhere near all of this time. I think I would probably conclude by a point that Justice Berger raised, that the frustration here by the appellant that there was a bad result and the bad result was missed is a common, perhaps a lay view on medical negligence. Well, there was an injury, and they missed it, therefore they got to pay for it. And as has been pointed out, this is not the law. The law says very clearly you have to prove a breach of standard of care. And if there's an expert that is admitted and he testifies, that's what the system is all about. The truth in this case is that the jury listened very carefully to the testimony of plaintiff's experts who said otherwise, and Dr. Miller who said there was no breach, as well as the testimony of Dr. Schweike himself, who defended his care, and they found that this injury could be missed without a breach of standard of care. The trial court heard all this, reviewed all this at the motion for new trial. The trial court upheld this without any abuse of discretion, and the appellees respectfully request that this court uphold the same.
Thank you.
Your Honor, in response to the missed injury issue, and I like the phrase missed injury doctrine, the emergency room, the trauma doctor, Dr. Miller, was talking about the seriously injured patient with multiple injuries who's brought into the emergency department. He has fractured ribs, broken ankle, head laceration, and so forth. And they're dealing with a variety of injuries, and in that context, he acknowledged they can miss injuries, and he says that happens in emergency departments, and that's what he's given lectures on. That's very different from this case, where they're focusing in exactly on this part of the anatomy, which they know is very complicated and should be handled by hand surgeons to begin with, and they're looking for this type of problem. So this is not a, quote, acceptable missed injury in that context. And then the to go to the back to the checklist.
Was that pointed out on cross-examination?
I thought it was. Okay. I thought it was. We'd gone into it at his deposition at some length and also in the courtroom. But I think the clincher from Dr. Miller's standpoint is his testimony that after the nerve impairment was clearly documented and detected post-surgery, he said, and I would just reiterate what I've said before, that someone on the trauma team needs to see the patient before he goes home. It has to be after they've recovered from anesthesia, examine them again, and send them home. Did not happen. Next question. And the failure for that to occur is a departure from standard of care? Correct. That's their expert acknowledging a deviation from the standard of care in the particular circumstances of this case. And I submit that...
Excuse me.
I'm sorry.
If somebody had looked at him after the surgery and detected something, what could have been done at that point?
Immediately call a hand surgeon, say that there's a nerve injury, we missed it, and we need an expert to come in and take a look at this. And it could have been done. These hand surgeons are on call 24 hours a day, and they're 30 minutes away.
Oh, but you're saying that you provided testimony that if somebody had looked at it after, you know, 3 hours after the surgery and determined that there was missed nerve injury, and then they called a hand surgeon, the hand surgeon could have fixed it?
Yes.
And there was evidence of that?
I think all of the surgeons acknowledge that this nerve injury could be repaired. Should have, the sooner the better. And if the trauma surgeon undertakes to do this job, which is at the far end of his capabilities, then he better do it right. And I don't think there was any disagreement at trial about a repair, probably not 100% successful repair, but a repair of that damaged nerve, and that happens. I don't want to say routine, but it certainly happens. That's all I have at this point.
Thank you.
Thank you, Aaron.
And thank you both for your arguments. The court will take the matter under advisement, and we'll also take a brief recess.